If you've ever wondered why Jesus was so unpopular that he ended up getting killed, some careful consideration of tonight's gospel reading might answer a few questions. We don't actually hear this story very often because this set of readings only comes up in years when there is an early Easter. And that's unfortunate because although it's not a popular story or necessarily an easy one to make immediate sense of, I think it's an extremely important one. The things that Jesus says publicly in this story are tough and uncompromising and would probably get him in just as much trouble today as they did then. And so if we are to be his followers, they ask some pretty tough questions of us and just where we stand. Jesus is already in trouble before this story starts. In Mark's gospel, we're only halfway through chapter 3, but already we've heard that after he healed a crippled man in the synagogue on the Sabbath, the Pharisees and the Herodians are already beginning to plot his downfall. You'd think this might be a time to pull in his head a bit, but instead, in today's episode, he comes out and publicly kicks two of the most sacred of sacred cows: loyalty to family and support for law and order. And in the process, he unmasks some of our most cherished delusions. The family question frames the episode. Evangelical Christians these days are very fond of proclaiming ourselves to be champions of the family and of family values. When Christians start political parties, they usually call them things like Family First, because it is assumed that commitment to family is a major Christian value that has appeal to the wider community. Whenever anybody's personal virtues are being trumpeted, they always start with they love their family and would do anything for them. Seems to be a virtue of just about everybody, apparently. But in Jesus' day, absolute allegiance to one's family was, if anything, even stronger. Families were mostly extended rather than nuclear, but one's allegiance to one's family was unquestionable, except by Jesus, it seems. Now, clearly, Jesus' family thought that it was time for him to pull his head in before someone took it off. The text tells us that they thought he was losing his mind and had come to take him home and get him out of harm's way. The ties that bind him to his family are to be the ties that restrain him and keep him out of trouble. And at that point, Mark interrupts the telling of the story with another story that helps us to see more clearly what the issues are with the family. So let's follow Mark and we'll come back to the family question when he does. The interruption comes in the form of the religious experts arriving from Jerusalem to deal with the growing hysteria around this religious maverick. Jesus had been calling into question the value of unswerving allegiance to the temple and its leaders and practices. He has been exposing demonic strongholds in the heart of the religious system, casting out demons in the synagogue and things like that. And when they arrive, they find no small amount of hysteria. Jesus is holed up in a house and he can't even get out to eat because there's this huge crowd gathered around outside trying to catch a glimpse of him. It's definitely time for the religious experts to reassert their authority and hose down the enthusiasm for this Jesus character. Now, the fact that Jesus has healed some people and exorcised some demons could not be denied, so they have to take a different tack. They take the time-honoured approach and question his motives and his methods. What he has done might look good at a glance, they suggest, but scratch a bit deeper and you'll find corruption and a callous disregard for the most important institutions that safeguard all we hold dear, like family and law and order and religion. These things that he's done are evidence of black magic. He's an agent of the devil, and we must all unite to resist him before he drags us all into the pit of hell. Now, Jesus' response to this only further galvanizes the fury against him, because what he does is effectively turn it back on his accusers. In effect, he says that it is the normal structures by which we maintain the institutions of society, family, religion, and law and order, it's them that are satanic. The satanic work you're accusing me of, he says, is what you are unwittingly engaged in yourselves. Let me show you how he says this. When they say that he uses the power of Satan to cast out demons, Jesus responds with a riddle. How can Satan cast out Satan? Now, at first glance, this seems to be a denial of the foundation of their argument. He seems to be saying that the Satan wouldn't attack his own, and therefore the charge is ridiculous. But actually, that's not where Jesus goes with it. He follows up by saying, if a kingdom is divided against itself, that kingdom cannot stand. And if a house is divided against itself, that house will not be able to stand. And if Satan has risen up against himself and is divided, he cannot stand, but his end has come. And of course, the idea that Satan's end has come is exactly what Jesus is saying. Which is why he goes straight on to the little parable. No one can enter a strong man's house and plunder his property without first tying up the strong man, and then indeed the house can be plundered. So Jesus is in fact claiming to be the apocalyptic thief in the night who has tied up the violent one and is now liberating all that is locked in his house. So yes, he implies, the Satan's end has come. Because Satan's house is divided and inherently unstable, and yes, the power of Satan is being used, but I'm not the one using it. What Jesus is pointing to and labelling as satanic here is the basic mechanism by which human cultures maintain their stability and normality whenever they are threatened. He is suggesting that the accusations that he is facing are far from unique. They are part of the normal pattern. When there is a major crisis and people become divided and start turning on one another, there is a mechanism that we always resort to unite people and get things back under control. Satan's house divided against itself. Divides against itself, and what we do is look for a culprit and then we turn on the culprit. We accuse the culprit of all manner of evil, of becoming the cause of all the problems, and of being the centre of an evil conspiracy that threatens to bring down our society. And as we relentlessly pile up the accusations, public hostility towards the culprit grows and grows until we find ourselves strangely united and unanimous in our verdict that the only way to rid ourselves of the chaos and division that threaten us is to rid ourselves of the culprit, to purge the community of this bringer of evil. And as we expel or execute the evil culprit, we feel purged and exhilarated and pure and united in a community of righteousness. Sometimes even the culprits get caught up in the frenzy and turn on themselves, begging to be punished and cast out in a kind of delusion of cleansing self-sacrifice. And thus, stability is restored, the community is saved. And it works. It's been working over and over and over since the dawn of civilization. But, says Jesus, it is a satanic structure. It is Satan casting out Satan. It is the majority doing the work of Satan by accusing the minority of being satanic troublemakers and then casting them out into death or exile. What does the title The Satan mean? The accuser. This work of heaping accusations on the culprit is inherently the work of Satan. And here you go again, says Jesus. This time you've decided that I'm the culprit, the victim, who must be demonized and eliminated for the sake of the community. And so the answer to the riddle, can Satan cast out Satan, is actually yes. Satan can, and Satan does. And as long as we can continue to be deluded into believing that we are doing the will of an angry, demanding, righteous God when we are purging these evils from among us, the structure of Satan casting out Satan, although inherently divided and unstable, will continue to see Satan's domain holding together against the threat of being overthrown by forgiveness and mercy and love. But now comes Jesus to bind the violent one and plunder his house. How? By untangling the ties that bind us to one another and to institutions of family and religion and order and law and order in this satanic conspiracy of scapegoating and purging. By exposing them. By exposing them for the idolatrous lie that they are, and showing us who God really is. In order to expose them, Jesus has to walk right into them and offer himself as the culprit, the victim, who absorbs the full force of our bitterness and rage, but who, instead of returning them so that they might regather and be ready for the next culprit, instead he swallows them and returns only love and forgiveness, thus unmasking the lie that God is pleased by our accusing and purging and sacrificing. By dying with only words of forgiveness on his lips and rising to life again, still breathing only words of mercy, Jesus reveals a God who does not sanction our righteous violence, a God who wants mercy, not sacrifice. And so in dying and rising, Jesus drove a fatal nail into these satanic structures, because those structures always depended on the frenzied unanimity of the crowd. And Jesus' radical and shocking acts of forgiveness forever shatter the unanimity. That's why they don't work as well as they used to anymore. I often wonder whether Jesus has forever regretted the way he worded the next thing that he said, the bit about the unforgivable sin, because it has been so constantly misunderstood and misused. Even the victims have sometimes used it against themselves to declare themselves guilty and endorse the community's action in purging itself of them. But of course, what Jesus is actually saying is that there's nothing we can do that would exhaust God's willingness to forgive you. There is nothing you can do that will put you beyond God's desire to gather you into God's love and mercy. The only way to remain unforgiven is to spit in the face of mercy and make yourself an avowed enemy of God's loving and forgiving and liberating work. And as the Apostle Paul would no doubt tell us from his own experience, even if it looks like you've disappeared off down that path, still God's love and mercy will follow you and call you back if you will let go of your spitting, snarling hostility to God's love. And so Jesus has bound the violent strongman and is rescuing us from his house, unbinding the ties that bound us to the structures of righteous indignation and sacred violence. But where does that leave the institutions that we've seen as so essential and to whom we have so unquestioningly given our allegiance? Well, Mark tells us Jesus' family arrived outside the house and sent word in that they had come to take him in hand. The ties that bind to the sacred institution of family were to be used to prevent him from shaking the foundations such that he would become the next culprit of the system. And what does Jesus do? He he pretty much disowns his family. "Who are my family?" he says. And looking at those who sat around him, he said, "Here are my true family. Whoever does the will of God is my brother and sister and mother." Exactly where we get the idea that Jesus is the champion of the traditional nuclear family is completely beyond me, but neither is Jesus saying that you should disown and abandon your family. What he is saying is that having been liberated from the strong man's house, from this relentless cycle of binding ourselves to one another by uniting us against outsiders in unanimous sacred violence, our primary allegiances are now formed through ties of common forgiveness and hospitality. We are bound to one another through our shared experience of liberating mercy. And nothing, not even the claims of family, should ever compromise that. If your family share a passion for mercy and love, then they are family indeed. But if they set out to stifle and repress the work of grace, then you have a higher allegiance to answer to. We might be fond of the saying that blood is thicker than water, but as Eugene Peterson puts it in his paraphrase of this passage, obedience is thicker than blood. And so it is as the new family, bound together by ties of shared obedience to God's radical ways of love and mercy and liberation made known in Christ, that we gather here to sing and pray and share at the table where love is tasted and forgiveness is poured out and all are free as Christ is free.